fighting for the independence of Vietnam. And that remained true right through the 30-year conflict.
That's Daniel Ellsberg with Mitch Jezerich talking about the roots of the Vietnam War. Maybe some of that will come out, the roots of the Afghan War in the future. It's interesting to note that the amount of money that went to France in the Marshall Plan was almost identical to the amount of money that they were spending in Indochina to reclaim their colonies. So we were actually just using them as a minion in a way of controlling the region. They were going to be our second, as it were, in the empire. Thanks for listening. There'll be some. I wanted to mention this. Somebody was trying to bring this to my attention. There's information. There's time to find out in a couple weeks from now, January 15th, on a Saturday, I guess it is. There'll be an event over at the IMC between 2 and 5. I think Sandunga is performing. I'm pretty sure it's a IWW-organized event about the community assembly for predicated on organizing the unorganized. And that's not a very good job, but keep your eyes up for that. There's a little information on the IMC calendar. There'll be more to come, and the Labor Hour people will probably have something on it next week, if not today. And it's time for me to haul out of here. Happy New Year. It's problematic that it'll be better than last, I think, but maybe we can hope. And thanks again for listening. Dave will be on the line with me, hopefully from California, doing the California Report next week. And after that, he'll be back in town, and we'll have a lot to catch up on. Have a good day, and hang around for the Labor Hour.
Hello, folks, and welcome to the January 1st, 2011 edition of the Illinois World Labor Hour, brought to you over the air on WEFT Champaign 90.1 FM and streaming online at weft.org. The views and opinions expressed in this hour of programming are those of the speakers and do not reflect the views and opinions of WEFT's management or board of directors. Now here's Jason with some acknowledgement of our underwriters.
This hour of programming is brought to you by the listeners of WEFT and by the Brotherhood of the Maintenance Way. The Brotherhood of the Maintenance Way employees are proud to continue their support for the Illinois World Labor Hour. A democratic union, BMWE, celebrates the voice for labor on WEFT. It is our hope that all workers may share the same benefits that we enjoy, such as living wages, job security, away-from-home expense pay, early retirement, Canadian-style health insurance, and guaranteed year-round work.
I'd like to make a comment on that. I have always, for several years, found to be a very dissatisfactory announcement. When that was written, there was some weird little kerfluffle on claims on some kind of political ad that people were wanting to run on CNN. And of course, the trendy people here at WEFT, whoever was involved with it, I don't know who that was, made them write that really awful announcement. They couldn't say good wages or high wages. They had to say living wages. And I'll tell you one thing right now, and I don't care if somebody wants to sue me or something, but the Brotherhood of the Maintenance of the Way employees make one hell of a lot more money than is defined as a living wage in this area. In fact, there is a living wage ordinance here. I can't remember what it is, but I bet the average BMWE worker makes twice that. I'm not sure what they mean by Canadian-style health care. I probably have Canadian-style health care with my laborer's insurance also. But that is just, I hope someday we can rectify that awful announcement. I've had up to here with it. It's just ridiculous.
All right. On to the AFL-CIO announcement then. Jason, you got another one there. Second page right there. Thanks, Bill.
Happy New Year, Bill.
Yes, to you too.
The Illinois Labor Hour is also supported in part by the AFL-CIO, which represents more than 7,000 workers in Champaign County and more than 13 million workers nationwide. Recognizing that strong workers build strong communities, the AFL-CIO is proud to support community radio in East Central Illinois.
Thanks, Jason. I'm your host, Bob Pelesny, here today with co-host Jason Kozlowski, and we'll have some workers' interest news for you. And no, we won't have the cultural corner because Tom's not here this week. And so also with us here today is Bill Gorrell. He was getting on his opinions there earlier. And so now here we're going to kick off workers' news this week with Jason's got a couple news stories for us.
Okay. Courtesy of HuffingtonPost.com, more than half of 15,000 people that Caterpillar Incorporated has hired this year were outside of the United States. UPS is also hiring at a faster clip overseas. For both companies and others, sales in international markets are growing at least twice as fast as domestically. This trend helps explain why unemployment remains high in the United States, edging up to 9.8% last month, even though companies are performing well. All but 4% of the top 500 U.S. corporations reported profits this year, and the stock market is close to its highest point since the 2008 financial meltdown. Yet, the jobs are going elsewhere. The Economic Policy Institute, a Washington think tank, says American companies have created 1.4 million jobs overseas this year compared with less than 1 million in the United States. The additional 1.4 million jobs would have lowered the U.S. unemployment rate to 8.9%, says Robert Scott, the Institute's senior international economist. Caterpillar, maker of the signature yellow bulldozers and tractors, has invested in three new plants in China in just the last 2 months to design and manufacture equipment. A few factors, at least in the case of Caterpillar, account for this. One is that China recently became the world's second largest economy. Another is the source of market demand for Asia and Pacific sales soared 38% in the first 9 months of the year compared with 16% in the U.S. Meanwhile, Caterpillar stock is up 64% this year. Not to be forgotten, China's workers' wages are typically but a fraction of their American counterparts. And additionally, not surprisingly, not considered by the New York Times when it covered this last November in an article, Caterpillar acquired for $7.6 billion Bucyrus International, manufacturer of large-scale surface and underground hauling and extraction equipment, especially for metal mining. That is, Caterpillar is banking on China's continued economic growth, fueled by high investment and low wages, and is increasingly relocating there.
I got a couple things to say about this in specific, because this is a type. This story really bothered me this week when I saw it, and I got two things coming. Yesterday, a couple of friends stopped by. One of them is a longtime Caterpillar employee from Decatur. And, he'd been through a lot of struggles there. And, we both reminisced about our dear friend, Larry Solomon, former president of that UAW local. But anyway, he was telling me, that their contract is up this spring.
Right.
So we need to really watch out. He said there's approximately 300 people left at that plant that are still on the top tier wage. And he's looking at possibly, and he's kind of looking forward to this. This guy just turned 60 years old. And personally, he's kind of looking forward to Caterpillar making some kind of offer to buy them all out to get rid of them and keep the low-wage employees.
Hmm.
And I'm going to tell you right now, if I was a new hire at Caterpillar, unless I was already a hardcore somehow union person, I would be sitting here wondering why I'm paying dues to a union that can't get me the same amount of money as everybody else. And those lower tier, the new hires there do not have the defined benefit UAW pension. They're on a 401k. So I'm looking probably sometime a few years down the road to the possible demise of the United Auto Workers, or probably a merger with, say, the steel workers or somebody, which is already about four merged different unions put together, five or six maybe. And on another thing, too, with basically, folks, the American population, this story shows that we are now obsolete and we are of no use to the ruling elites of this country and the world. The only thing that saved our bacon in the past was that we were the consumers of last resort. Now they are making more money overseas than they are making here. Not only are they paying lower wages, they are making more money overseas. They don't need us anymore. And if you want to look at the possible future, I suggest that you go out and find DVDs of the following movies. Zardoz, starring Sean Connery in one of his strangest roles, a John Borman movie. Soylent Green, which has a scene where Edgar G. Robinson, in a film made in 1973, is talking about how great things were before everything got hot because of the greenhouse effect.
Yep.
And that was based on a book written in 1966 by Harry Harrison called Make Room, Make Room. Can you believe it, folks? Some people still deny it. And I would also, more recent movies, The Book of Eli in the little bit farther future, and the incredibly good movie, but just awfully depressing, The Road, based on the book by, Coleman McCarthy, I think. But it's called The Road, and it is one of the bleakest movies I've ever seen in my life. But it is the future, folks. You are obsolete. They don't need you. They're going to cook you in this global warming, and then they're going to retreat to domed estates circling the Arctic, around the Arctic Circle. Eventually, I'm glad. I wish I was 20 years older, man. I dread the next two decades.
Bill, I came into the studio in such a good mood.
Oh, Happy New Year, everybody.
Happy New Year, yes. I got a story here that I've been meaning to get on the air for the last couple of weeks. It says, while nearly 27 million U.S. workers are either jobless or in need of full-time work, America's corporations are sitting on record profits that could be used to put people back on the job. It says the U.S. Department of Commerce reported back at the end of November that American companies just had their best quarter ever, earning profits at an annual rate of $1.659 trillion in the third quarter. The next highest annual corporate profits level on record was in the third quarter of 2006. In fact, American corporate profits have grown for seven straight quarters. That's some of the fastest rates in history. Economists say the record profits can be attributed to strong productivity growth, companies making more with fewer people, and the companies spending the money in and sending jobs to fast-growing countries such as China and India. As a result of the Federal Reserve's consistent long-term lowering of interest rates, corporations have rarely had it better, they say. Consumer spending and the American Recovery Act have fueled what little growth there has been in the U.S. economy, says Heidi Scherholz, who's an EPI, Economic Policy Institute economist. One of the key engines growing the economy is extended unemployment insurance benefits, she said. And back also from Huffington Post, they say that through September, banks had $981 billion in excess reserves at the 12 regional Federal Reserve banks across the country. So that kind of goes along with what we were saying here. These corporations are making record profits, and they're getting rid of all of their employees.
And isn't it sad that what's described as one of the biggest growth sectors of the economy is basically just buttressing people's misery with, trying to provide some modest floor?
Yes.
It's just sad. And before getting to this next news item, to piggyback briefly on Bill's soliloquy earlier, a lot of these newer Caterpillar workers are essentially at-will employees. Many are not even union members at all. They just right. don't have rights of, as far as for overtime pay, holiday pay, anything. They don't have health insurance. They're really essentially at-will as well as at risk. I thought of this next story, especially as I heard a couple weeks ago a right-winger shilling for Walmart during a radio show here on WEFT. In December, Walmart decided to end its practice of paying workers an extra dollar per hour on Sundays starting today.
Hi, Jermaine.
Happy New Year. For those such as Columbia professor and international relations expert Dorian Warren, who might consider this a pay cut for the company's beleaguered workers, who, to remind, as a group have already endured anti-unionism, racially and gender discriminatory hiring and promotion practices, wage and overtime theft, and other crimes, fear not. Walmart's move merely reflects a change in workplace reality, according to Craig Rowley, vice president of the retail practice at the consulting firm Hay Group in Dallas. According to an annual survey conducted by Hay, only 20% of retailers still offer any sort of Sunday premium, Rowley said in an interview. It's a declining practice, he said. When retailers first started opening their stores on Sundays, it was common to have the premium because they were asking employees to do something they never had to do before. But today, working retail requires that you work weekends. It's part of the job, end quote. Thus, construing as antiquated the practice of paying workers a little extra for sacrificing their time on the weekend to spend with family, friends, and leisure, in church, or merely resting is nothing more than Walmart's merely catching up with the times. As the late great comedian Bill Hicks would remark, go back to bed, America. Everything is under control.
Yeah, you know, Walmart, and they come on with their nice commercials, and they have their employees in their commercials. It's like, gee, I started working here right after high school, and now I'm up to some kind of thing that has manager in the title. And I tell you what, guys, I don't work too many weekends. You know why? Because any Saturday I work, as soon as I walk on that job, it's going to cost them 1.5 times what I think. I believe it's $47.10 an hour, plus $10 at least in benefits, plus whatever. I think it's $4 or more an hour in my pension. All right, and Sundays and holidays, double time.
Yeah,
Walmart workers of the world, unite.
Yes.
All you have to lose is your poor pay and working conditions.
Wake up, Walmart.
And if people think it's a good thing, that Walmart's a good, all right job, even if you don't get paid, that maybe it's all right working there, I suggest that you read Barbara Ehrenreich's book, Nickeled and Dimed in America, when she worked at Walmart.
Yep.
And it was a difficult, hard job, more akin to a warehouse, a factory, or a mine than you might think of as a retail store.
No doubt about it.
Okay, there's a proposed NLRB rule that requires employers to post workers' rights. Most workers have seen notices about their right to a minimum wage or a safe workplace posted in the company break room or elsewhere on the job. Employers are required to post these notices by federal law. But there is no requirement for employers to post any sort of notice about workers' rights under the National Labor Relations Act, NLRA, including the right to form a union. Now the National Labor Relations Board is proposing a rule that would require employers to post such notices in the workplace. AFL-CIO President Richard Trumka says the proposed rule is a common-sense policy needed in today's workplace. Every working person in America deserves to know his or her rights. The rule ensures that workers' rights are effectively communicated in the workplace. It is necessary in the face of widespread misunderstanding about the law and many workers' justified fear of exercising their rights under it. According to the proposed rule published in the Federal Register, the NLRB believes that many employees protected by the NLRA are unaware of their rights under the statute. The intended effects of this action are to increase knowledge of the NLRA among employees, to better enable the exercise of rights under the statute, and to promote statutory compliance by employers and unions. Says Trumka, when workers know their rights, they can make the best decisions for themselves and their families.
The U.S. Department of Labor's Occupational Safety and Health Administration has cited DePaulo Company in Glenview, Illinois, with one willful and nine serious safety violations for allowing workers in Elgin to perform trenching and excavation work at depths of up to 12.5 feet without cave-in protection. The citations carry total penalties of $113,000. DePaulo Company specializes in installing underground water and sewer pipes. OSHA's inspection, initiated in June, cited the company with one willful violation for failing to provide cave-in protection for these workers. Cave-in protection is required when employees are working in an excavation at a depth greater than 5 feet. The violation has a proposed fine of $70,000. Additionally, the company was issued nine serious violations with proposed penalties of $43,000 for failing to provide fall protection for shoring systems and walkways, failing to properly train flaggers, and having spliced flexible extension cords and unapproved repairs to electrical cords. Prior to this inspection, DePaulo had been inspected by OSHA 20 times since 1982 and received 33 citations, many for similar trenching violations. In 1993, the company received four citations when a worker was fatally injured on a job site. The company has 15 business days from receipt of its latest citations and penalties to comply.
I also say, as a laborer, this story is very important to me because it's the exact same conditions that I work under. And if folks don't think that it's very important to be very careful when putting people in ditches and holes, I guess they weren't around one day. Maybe 10 years ago, I was driving on Prospect Avenue over Route 74, and I looked, and there was no traffic. Why was there no traffic? Because down by the Neal Street Bridge, they were putting in some sewer, and there was a man who was buried in that ditch, and they were trying to get him out, and they wanted no traffic on that road because they were afraid the vibrations would cause dirt to fall back in. Now, I tell you what, when I'm a top man on a pipe job, one of the biggest parts of that job is watching those banks and protecting that bottom man down there.
Yep.
Electrical cords. And here's something too, OSHA. When OSHA comes, the company knows they're coming.
Yeah.
And how did they? I was on a job once at the Urbana Middle School for a local contractor, and we knew OSHA was coming, and so they gathered up several miles of electrical cords and hit them because they were afraid.
Several miles.
Huh? I mean, we had this huge pile of cords that were hidden from the inspectors.
Huh.
But it's very important, folks. People's lives are on the line with all of these laws.
Yeah.
And I guess we can thank Richard Nixon for going ahead and signing that bill. Not just Richard Nixon. We should thank the people that were out in the streets and responding to public opinion polls in the late 1960s and early 1970s, folks. Even the Supreme Court can be turned by those actions. Just look back at that history. Many people do call Nixon the last liberal president because of things like that, but he never would have done that without the pressure from the people in the streets. And I don't mean, I've been saying we need to take to the streets. No, we need to take away the streets. Maybe I'll get into this later. I think we need much more radical opposition before things go too far.
I also think we should thank the thousands and thousands of people who died and have been injured and maimed on the jobs to finally spur this, if flawed, agency for actually existing, too.
If you ever see Ann Feeney, she always tells you how many workers were killed every year in America. She keeps a running tally of that, and it's amazing how many workers are killed on the job.
Yeah. God bless Ann Feeney. Yeah.
Yes, and everybody, we all hope that Ann has a good year recovering from her recent cancer.
Yes.
Bout with cancer, and that her hair, that wonderful hair that she had, grows back out.
Yes. I got a little story here about Toyota. They've hired the first of an expected 2,000 workers at its partially completed Mississippi manufacturing plant, which will be brought online to assemble Corollas, according to a Wall Street Journal report. That's good news for the economically depressed northeastern Mississippi region, where unemployment reportedly is running as high as 11%. Toyota initially announced plans for the plant in 2007, but halted work on it a year later as the global economy tanked. The Japanese automaker says it expects to boost capacity utilization at its U.S. manufacturing plants to 90% this year, compared with last year's lackluster 60% plant utilization. Last year, Toyota hit the brakes on its operations at its New United Motor Manufacturing plant in Fremont, California, NUMMI, after its joint venture partner, General Motors, filed for bankruptcy. That put 4,700 NUMMI workers out on the street. But the Japanese automaker, which is teaming up with Tesla Motors to produce an electric RAV4 vehicle, is reportedly considering manufacturing the vehicles at the former NUMMI plant, which Tesla now owns. Though Toyota's reputation continues to take a beating as a December recall of its Sienna minivans and concerns about the brake systems on the Prius Hybrid add to its earlier recall woes, the automaker did manage to post a 5.8% sales gain to reach $59.5 billion in the fiscal second quarter and a $1.2 billion profit. And Toyota and other manufacturers recalled 20 million vehicles in 2010. Besides Toyota, General Motors recalled as many as 4 million vehicles, and Nissan recalled 2 million vehicles.
I'm of mixed emotions about this story because I despise these non-union plants. That was a union plant in California.
NUMMI was, yes.
Right.
And the Mississippi one is not.
Yes. But I do tell you, I am so sick of internal combustion engines. Right now, I got a Ford Focus that's got problems. It's had a problem with the EGR, which is the exhaust gas recirculation system. That's an annoying problem. Right now, I've got a worse problem is that my number one cylinder, the spark plug in it, had stopped firing. I'm afraid it might have a cracked head and be getting coolant in there because I'd had a problem with another sensor that turns on the electric fan to cool the radiator when you're sitting still. And you know what? If that car had an electric motor, there would be no exhaust gas to recirculate, there would be no spark plug, and there would be no coolant to worry about. In fact, that is why you do not have electric cars, because General Motors and the car makers, they looked at this and they realized that if they started building electric cars, they would lose, look at this, no air filters, no fuel filters, no radiators, no spark plugs, no spark plug wires. I mean, and no oil changes, no oil filters, on and on and on, and it would have put Delco Remy and Motorcraft, their parts divisions, aftermarket parts divisions, out of business.
They can still sell you a battery for $8,000, Bill.
You know, but, you know, I'm, who is it? Oh, I can't remember this woman. She was Phyllis Diller.
You remember Phyllis Diller?
Yeah.
I was reading the other day a thing that Phyllis Diller wrote. She remembered her aunt's electric car. They were building electric cars 100 years ago in this country.
Yes.
And they weren't using really long extension cords. You know, just think, man, I never need to go 200 miles in a day's time. That's pretty rare. I would love an electric car. I would love a mass transit system that would stop somewhere reasonably close to my house, like there used to be. It's amazing. One time I did a paper that was based on why movie theaters close in the small towns. And if you take graphs, if you would make graphs of things like miles of paved road, somehow quantify comfort and reliability of cars and so on and so forth, that graph would go up. Then if you take another graph that charts the number of businesses in small towns, that graph would be heading down as it goes to the right because cars killed small towns. B-Ment used to have a movie theater. B-Ment used to have a department store. B-Ment barely has a hardware store now. I mean, it's just, I was kind of hoping when those gas went back up a few years ago, that would be a revival of the small town.
Yeah.
But, I don't know. Anyway, that's going on.
Bill.
Don't you realize
pollution provides jobs?
Yes.
Well, I need the road work this year, too. We need to, to get some asphalt and shoveled around. And
so let's build bigger and heavier vehicles.
That's right. We need to
Bill employed.
We need to deregulate trucking by raising the weight limits so that they tear up the roads faster.
All right. How about a little bit of music here, and then we'll come back with a special feature.
All right. I like special.
Go, go.
And we're back, and you are listening to WEFT Champaign 90.1 FM and online at weft.org. And that was Albert King with Cadillac Assembly Line. A great, great classic blues song there.
Yeah.
So here's Jason with a public service announcement.
On any given night, Joe Roberts camps out on a cold street corner in a major metropolitan city. Tonight, some people almost brought Joe something to eat. Someone else almost drove him to a shelter. And another almost brought him a warm blanket. And Joe Roberts, well, he almost made it through the night. As generous a nation as we are, sometimes instead of giving, we almost give. But almost giving is the same as not giving at all. Don't almost give, give. To find out how you can help, visit don'talmostgive.org. A message brought to you by the Ad Council.
And homelessness is a problem that still exists in our community. Have you wondered what you could do to help? Well, the Time Center in Champaign is a transitional living program for homeless men, providing meals, housing, and professional staff 24/7 to assist in ending homelessness in our community, one person at a time. To find out how you can volunteer, call 398-7785. That's 398-7785. And I'd also like to remind you, you can tune in to Labor's View TV program every Sunday at 4 p.m. on local Comcast cable channel 6.
Oh, by the way, I was just wondering, have they done or is it scheduled to have the homeless marathon this year with Mr. Nobody?
I think it was done in the fall, Bill.
I missed it then. Yeah, that was, I mean, they did it here one time.
The first one, I think they did right outside the station here.
Well, it wasn't the first one. We'd been doing it for a few years before that, but they did one right here. Mr. Nobody came to town, and it was interesting because there was a car dealership where the guy was going by Mr. Nobody, and people were confused.
All right, and now we've got a special feature this week. Jason is going to do a story. We're going to talk about the 1937 sit-down strike in Flint, Michigan.
Yeah. It started December 30th, 1936, so I figured because of the date it was a good thing to talk about. And I also think that even though, it might seem hackneyed to talk about the language state of the labor movement and all that, I really think the Flint sit-down strike is a good lesson to remember, not just for its historical significance, but also because it occurred at a time that was different in some ways and after the passage of the National Labor Relations Act, but very much similar to these times in that I think people did not expect so much of the change that ended up coming. That is, it was in its own way certainly equally bleak, if not bleaker, for American workers. And, the sit-down strike provides a lot of lessons, I think, worth remembering. And a little bit of background on this. I think sit-down strikes are presented as spontaneous events, and sometimes they are, but oftentimes they're not. And Flint, in its own way, was an admixture of spontaneity and a considerable degree of planning that resulted from an organizing drive in the middle of 1936 that had to occur largely in secret in Flint because it was a de facto company town that GM had essentially controlled and had riddled with spies both in the town and in the factory. It had also occurred with an awful lot of seed money from the CIO and the United Mine Workers. And important, too, especially since radicals have really been pushed out of so much of the labor movement, especially after Taft-Hartley, it's important to remember that this and so many organizing drives in the 30s simply would not have occurred without the roles or important role of radicals. Wyndham Mortimer was an important organizer during this period, who, along with Walter Reuther's younger brother Roy Reuther, was involved in organizing here at Flint and was subsequently greeted at his hotel room hours after arriving in Flint with a phone call from an anonymous person threatening him with stuffing him in a pine box should he continue with his organizing drive, and yet proceeded anyway. And again, this organizing had to occur largely in secret. But
well, actually, somebody did shoot Walter Reuther while he was in his kitchen one evening. I don't know how close it was to this particular strike.
It was in the late 40s.
Oh, was that in the late 40s? But yeah. I remember at one point they shot him, and I think it injured his arm or something, shot through with a shotgun.
Yeah, permanently. Yeah.
I mean, even after this, when they were pretty much installed.
For sure. Absolutely. Absolutely, when they were entrenched. The most dangerous man in Detroit, as the Nelson Lichtenstein book is.
Lichtenstein, he's very good.
Brilliant guy.
Oh, Oh, yeah, and I just wanted to say, too, you know, I know that if people decided that they needed to strike right now, what would happen is the media and everybody would immediately jump on them and say, look, things are slow, this is a bad time.
Right.
Well, 1936 wasn't exactly a boom year.
Right.
You know, keep that in mind, folks.
Yeah, it's absolutely true. In some of these brief details of the strike, and I'll talk about it early on, and we have a good piece to play there that with an awful lot of organizing leading up to this, they had discerned that GM had only two factories that produced dies for parts manufacturing at this time. One was in Flint, and the other one was in Cleveland. And a strike in Cleveland on December 30th actually ended up precipitating this sit-down strike, where initially it was really not going to happen as it did. GM was going to move out the dies from there, and upon learning this, workers then struck and essentially did not leave the factory. And it took over Flint's Fisher 1 plant. It received considerable support in the coming stretches. From the inside, workers were extremely organized, enforcing strict rules and disciplines such as no drinking, smoking only in restricted areas, having regular exercise, assigning various job responsibilities, caring for the facilities and equipment so there wasn't this idea of sabotage that the companies propagated around strikes, but certainly over sit-downs, electing a mayor, discouraging other workers from entering the facility, and crucially, as came up, as we'll discuss in a minute, constructing barricades to prevent guards' intrusion, but also tools for weapons. If an invasion of the plant ended up occurring, which it did, on the outside there was an awful lot of support from factory workers, many of whom were unemployed, non-GM workers, strikers as well. Important to note the role of women, women's auxiliaries, who not just made food and provided it for workers on the inside, but picketed en masse outside. Politically, Frank Murphy was elected governor of Michigan, a Democrat, very much on support of labor, but also with the expectation of supporting the UAW, which he did. Early on, in early January, soon after this, there was an injunction that was issued in order to end the strike and remove the strikers, and it was determined, as the UAW investigated, that the judge had $200,000 in GM stock.
Man, that's a chunk of money back,
back
then.
Yeah. Absolutely.
That's like a bit, $2 million back then.
Yeah, yeah, really.
Probably.
Absolutely. And this, you know, not only tainted him, but also prevented him from providing another ruling in this case. And setting this up, too, that really this, like so many strikes in the 1930s, became violent. And with strikers not being evicted and with the considerable support this had gained, GM, especially with this the failure of this injunction, GM on January 11th, in the morning of January 11th, and by the way, this was a very cold winter up in Flint, shut off the heat to the building.
Right.
Company guards stationed outside hid in the women's bathroom while police in full riot gear tried to storm the building by force. And were beaten back. They were using tear gas, shooting it inside the building, but also on strikers outside and shooting some strikers, 14 of whom were injured. And there was considerable resistance from inside and outside with fights with the police, but also from inside. Sit-downers had assembled various implements, including rubber hoses, and made slingshots, and were shooting and flinging door hinges at the police in order to fire them back, move them back. So after a few hours, the police eventually retreated, giving the name to this incident, the Battle of the running bulls being the police running away, and set the stage, really, for this eventually successful strike, but which lasted 44 days. And we have a some very good stuff that Bob actually assembled with some good retrospectives and some first-person accounts of some people who talk about the second part of the strike that we'll play for you now.
Okay.
Was in its 29th day, and the men in the plant were beginning to feel the strain of separation from family and friends.
We never expected to have a strike that long. We thought, you know, my God, how are we going to keep them in? But here, this was on for over a month, so we said something has to be done to add spirit to the strike and give it a lift.
The strike leaders devised a secret plan to deliver a crippling blow to the heart of the General Motors operation. Their target was a vital and heavily guarded building, GM Engine Plant Number 4. To draw the guards away from the engine plant, they staged a mock strike at Plant Number 9. Even the men in Plant 9 thought that this was a real strike. Union leaders hoped that they would fight just long enough for the UAW to take control of the engine plant.
It was announced that we were going in front of Chevy 9. And all the women, it was a tremendous picket line, you know, were standing there right in front, and we had clubs, you know, just for the sake of having clubs, F7. We didn't know what we were going to use for them. Then suddenly, one of the strikers in Chevy 9 broke the window, and he yelled out, "The guards are choking us." Yes. And that was gas. All of us dashed and broke all the windows possible.
The battle in Plant 9 raged for 45 minutes, and many inside were severely beaten, but the plan worked. The engine plant, left unguarded, was seized.
How could anybody absolutely just fall for something like that? All right, they didn't know what was going to happen. But to take the 200 police that they had in Chevy 4 and to take them out and just put them, why didn't they leave 200 here and 200 in another place, you know? Well, they didn't. They absolutely were stupid.
Inspiration through the workers' blood shall run. There can be no power greater.
The union had forced the largest automaker in the world to the bargaining table. On February 11, 1937, General Motors and the UAW signed a single-page contract. GM was the first of the big three to recognize the union.
Solidarity forever.
You know, you were there for over a month, never sleeping, never eating, never knowing what was going to happen the next day, you know. You were just sort of as if you were in a dream, really. And then suddenly it happened, you know. They came out. You saw them coming out, you know. It was just wonderful.
Years now, the effect of what we did in 37 will still be going on. I'm sure of that, because we were the forerunners of the civil rights, equal rights, and we went down for the rights of our sisters to belong to the union and join it and work with us.
Labor's sit-down hysteria spreads. At the height of the strike that closed four of Detroit's leading hotels for 2 days, armed police blocked the doors. 2,500 guests have had to leave. Waitresses, cooks, and bellhops refuse to work, but find time for play. Mrs. Martin Johnson, crippled widow of the late explorer, is one of the guests compelled to move out. In the arms of an obliging cop, Mrs. Johnson takes her troubles quite cheerfully. Ethel Chate, famous radio singer, has just arrived. The law says she shall not pass, so Ethel decides on a sit-down of her own.
After the sit-down strike, people organized themselves. They came by literally the tens of thousands, and all kinds of people. They were all joining the CIO. They weren't joining the UAW or this, that, the other union. They were joining the CIO. It was a crusade.
Everybody sat down. In Detroit, all nine Chrysler factories sat down, and Chrysler signed within a month. The second of the big auto companies had recognized the union. In 1 year's time, the membership of the UAW had grown to a quarter of a million strong, and a local business weekly declared, "The revolution is here."
Good stuff. A few lessons I think worth remembering from this, both particular to the 1930s and also looking back on, and maybe some things to consider for our time. I think the most obvious thing is that mass and creative militant action from workers can be successful. It's important, I think, to remember this. There was no guarantee that this was going to be successful, and considering the sort of resistance, especially state resistance that had occurred, that's important to remember, too. The UAW grew from this, although it came in fits and spasms a bit. It had immediately gained credibility with GM, but was not able to organize at Ford until 1941. But its membership had actually waned from this due to the return of the Depression in the late 1930s, and really had become more solidified, like so many major industrial unions by World War II. Important, too, that there was credibility for this and real power that grew from the CIO and the UAW, but not just in the auto industry, but you saw the power and credibility of John Lewis grow as a result of this. It led directly to the successful and almost shocking unionization without an organizing strike, which was very much what these sorts of things were at the time, at U.S. Steel in March of 1937. It was absolutely the fear of a sit-down strike occurring in these places as unionization and organizing was starting to occur. That was why U.S. Steel settled, much to the chagrin of the so-called little steel companies. It was the power of the sit-down.
Excuse me, was there a massacre somewhat at some time at a steel plant?
Many, but yeah, there was the Memorial Day massacre in Chicago in 1937 that was part of the push against from the so-called little steel companies.
Yeah, I thought there was something at Bethlehem Steel, possibly in Pennsylvania, and it was alluded to in the film The Cradle Will Rock, which was the stage play in The Cradle Will Rock. The Cradle Will Rock is a movie about a play that was supposed to be put on during the 1930s, but it did not happen because the WPA did not want to allow it to happen, and the play that was supposed to be put on was based on an occurrence where some people were shot during a steel strike somewhere. I'm sorry, I shouldn't even have brought it up without reason.
No. It's actually worth
I thought maybe you had
into,
run across it there.
No, unfortunately not. Something as when we talked.
But the 1935 Memorial Day Massacre, I've seen a film of that.
Yeah.
And it was just, I mean, people were just literally shot in the back by the police at the behest of the steel companies at that time.
Absolutely. 10 people murdered.
Folks, and this is something I want to mention, something that I've always thought. No person should ever run for a union office without first declaring that they are at least willing to go to jail for their membership. What we've been talking about right now, these sit-down strikes and such, the building trades in Champaign used to be strong and powerful, and they used to do things. Dave Johnson has discussed when my local union back in the day, even though it was under a very corrupt regime, well, we would do direct action, and we would get the goods. And he talked about one site with a motel here on out in the North Prospect area sprawl that was being built when the laborers showed up, flipped over the office trailer, cut the phone and the power lines, and basically held a riot there. And the police showed up, and they were so close with us, it was basically, hey guys, it's time to go home. Nobody got arrested. We need to return to that. And nobody should ever run a building trades local in this town unless they are willing to go to jail. They should be the people out there and the first person to be arrested if it's going to happen.
Yes. I did want to mention again, I think Paul Muth brought this up in his last show, that there is a community assembly going on January 15th at the IMC from 2 p.m. to 5 p.m. It's Organizing the Organizers, a community assembly, and it's an IWW-sponsored assembly around community organizing in Champaign-Urbana. And any other wrap-ups on that sit-down strike, Jason?
Yeah, I'll finish with that, and then one thing, and I think we might have a song to play if there's time, that lastly, that this was something that it wasn't, the sit-down as a tactic wasn't new to Flint. It's worth noting, too, but there were other examples of this, including in the Midwest. Bendix Break is one prime example, but this is something that was absolutely becoming an international tactic. It occurred in places in France
became
and Italy in the 30s.
A fad somewhat after the Flint strike, didn't it? I mean, I've read were like waitresses,
yes,
retail employees.
Exactly. Yeah. Yes, big time. And that was exactly why it was ruled illegal within a year, was because this was something that that people, workers of all kind, men and women, people of color in various jobs all over the place were doing, too. One note on a slightly unrelated note to the sit-downs, but that I've set up a blog where people can go and discuss things related to issues, and where, especially after we've recorded the shows, where we post links for this at Radio for All. And I'll give you the URL. It's at www.illinoisworldlaborhour.wordpress.com. And you can set up through a very simple feature through WordPress. You can create an account in order to comment on different things that we have there. I posted some past stories, including about the Metropolis workers who are locked out. There was a good deal of background and some links there that we put up. So you can definitely visit that and not just listen to shows that we'll hopefully have archived there, but also there are various links to news organizations and different media outlets, as well as comment on the things that we discuss here on the show.
Okay, and I think we're going to finish up here. I got a song titled 1937. It was written by David O. Norris, and this is sung by Dan Hall, and it's all about the 1937 sit-downs.
I packed my last guitar away and started driving home. My head is full of songs and smoking while I drove along. What made me go down Chevrolet, I guess I'll never know. At 1 a.m. the place was lit with amber streetlight glow. Is this the place where brave men stood to corporation power and yell to the winds, to hell with you, this is the workers' hour. Simple men with work-worn hands and lives not worth a damn formed a line to live or die once the fight began. Is there a truer heart today than those who took a stand? In 1937, cold, the sit-down strike would end. They left their wives and babies alone to face uncertainty, and what they earned when spirits burned was passed today to me. And all the fakes who tried to make us go, we stand for right and we'll win this fight, match them toe to toe. So bring them on, we're waiting here to fight or talk, you choose. And while we hold our brother's hand, the worker will never lose. Is there a truer heart today than those who took a stand? In 1937, cold, the sit-down strike would end. They left their wives and babies alone to face uncertainty, and what they earned when spirits burned was passed today to me. Thank you. voice still echoes here to rally up the crowd. And as long as we still hear the voice of 37 strong, they'll live within and guide our path that leads us ever on. Is there a truer heart today than those who took a stand in 1937, called the sit-down strike would end? They left their wives and babies alone to face uncertainty in what they earned when spirits burned was past. Spirits burned was passed today to me.